Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, we are really excited to have with us Flavia Richardson. Flavia is currently Chief Commercial Officer at Juice Ventures, an early stage multi-product financing offering for growth ventures. She was previously Vice President of the early stage practice at Silicon Valley Bank and Portfolio Manager at Funding London, which was part of the London Co-Investment Fund. And if that weren't enough, Flavia also supports founders and ventures as a mentor and advisor. Hi, Flavia. Welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Hi, Arish. Thank you for having me. Really nice to be able to join you.
Amazing. So let's just jump right into it. It'd be great for our listeners if you could give us a bit of a snapshot about your background, because you've been sort of on the investing side of the table, you're operating, and then you've kind of gone to and fro. It'd be great to understand from you a little bit about your journey.
Oh, amazing. I started almost 10 years ago working for P&O, the investment arm. Being parachuted from finishing 6 years of studying law and qualifying to doing investment assessments and ascertaining, you know, whether a specific technology has enough defensibility in a market. So I have been, you know, parachuted into this ecosystem quite a long time ago, and it has been a privilege to be able to work with so many amazing companies over the years across my portfolios. Some of them now are doing exceptionally well. You probably guys know companies like Curve, Wagestream, Patch, Urban. We're celebrating these amazing companies every single day. And it has been quite an amazing journey for me to be able to support them when they were at early stage as a portfolio manager and to see them over the years going from strength to strength. Yes, over the last 2 years and a half, I have been with Silicon Valley Bank, working within the early stage practice, working with some of the most amazing companies in our ecosystem, some that I'm not going to touch due to confidentiality today, but I can tell you guys that have been some of the most amazing fundraisers that we have seen in the last 6 months. So it has been quite a journey, and it gave me the courage to go and join an initiative very early on and be able to apply all of these things that I have picked up in the last 10 years.
There's a huge amount I'm going to be digging into later, so I don't want to preempt all of that. But one thing that I think, you know, really is going to be very interesting for our listeners is just how financial products for early stage businesses have changed in recent times. Obviously, you're in revenue-based financing, which we're going to talk about in more detail, but it seems like there's been a whole explosion of products out there on the market. Could you just take us through a little bit about how that has changed over the last number of years from your perspective?
Amazing. Oh, I'm going to give you guys a short history of rundown of how we kind of evolved over the last 10 years. When I joined this ecosystem, we kind of had the banks that were pretty much lending and the government, British Business Bank. I think it even British Business Bank had a different name then. And we kind of went from that just as sort of regular banks providing debt to companies to maybe peer-to-peer. And if you remember, there were quite a number of platforms in the peer-to-peer space. So that was kind of the first version of the products that founders in technology were able to access a few years ago. But obviously there were substantial issues. First of all, the liquidity, the interest was very, very high. There was lack of predictability of whether you're going to get funded. So there was not that much difference between following that process and going for a crowdfunding campaign on one of the major platforms we have here in the UK. Then we kind of, Silicon Valley Bank made quite a lot of inroads. Then we had Columbia Capital Partners, and then we had Kreos and Boost and all the other venture debt players and funds, especially kind of American-backed And Venture Dead was still a new product, 5 years ago. The market wasn't open to it. Venture capital investors, at least the very early stage ones, couldn't understand where it fits in. And therefore, there was not that much knowledge about how to use it, how to scale using debt. I think if we fast forward over the last 2 years, where I think that the milestone and the sort of inflection has happened in our ecosystem, we can see not just revenue-based lending coming to Europe and to the UK more specifically through organizations like Wayflyer, Clearco, Uncapped, and many, many others that have done extremely well. But we see quite a spectrum of different products that are resolving a unique problem. So almost like a single purpose facility. And we see companies like Pipe coming from the US for SaaS enterprise and SaaS businesses, almost doing like invoice discounting approach, but much easier, much more tech based. And we see the whole ecosystem booming with various different solutions. So I feel that right now in our ecosystem, we're at the point where the venture capital activity is so intense that we're starting to ask the questions that are really important. Whether is equity the cheapest way to get the company from one stage to another, or is there a different tool that I could use? And many founders in the market can answer the question with yes, there are quite a number of solutions for me, depending on the problem that I want to solve.
Wow, that's a bit of a roller coaster ride through financing, certainly in the UK. It's really interesting what you just said there at the end, because I think that whole question of cost of capital is one that a lot of founders maybe who haven't come from business or finance backgrounds don't necessarily understand immediately. And therefore, you have this whole conversation around, you know, is debt more expensive than equity? And kind of the way I try and explain it is, you know, if you sell 10% of your business today for £1 million, but you exit for 100 million, then, you know, effectively that's cost you £9 million. Whereas if you take out £1 million debt line and, you know, I don't know, it's repayable over 5 years at, I don't know, 10% coupon, it's not going to cost you £10 million or £9 million. And I think that's a really important thing for founders to understand. So let's take a deeper dive into revenue-based financing, which is obviously something that you're heavily involved in at Juice. Why do you think it's exploded this much of late? Is that down to this sort of trade-off between equity and debt in terms of pricing? Is it more to do with the fact that, as you say, the tech is now enabling you to get to a decision quicker? What do you think has really pushed it forward?
Oh, that is such a good question. I think there are a number of elements, and perhaps the best way to approach it would be to kind of put it on the three headers. The first one, I think it was, for me, I call it the debt resistance. Our ecosystem has for many, many generations been quite resistant to using debt to scale a company. Equity has always seen by founders as a lot more convenient because there was no kind of repayment point. It was a degree of comfort that you had as a founder when you took equity from someone. You didn't feel the pressure of paying it back. You just focused on your company and building your company. But now we're starting to realize that with the velocity of developing and going from one stage to the next, we're actually mimicking a debt cycle rather than an equity cycle. The idea is to scale a company and sell it in somewhere between 5 to 7 years. So we're comfortable with kind of short sprints and maybe long-term debt for at the right inflection points. And there's a lot more education in our ecosystem. We see some of the best companies at Series B's and C's and D's using it. We're getting a lot more comfortable with debt. I would say that the second element, and as you rightfully mentioned, it is technology. It is becoming so much easier to apply, be approved, and have your money in a bank. We're moving to a place when that is done in real time. And every single one of the providers has a different way of underwriting, different data that they're basing their decision. And it's a frictionless process. Because it's a frictionless process, many founders actually want to go and opt for that, because it's not what it used to be with paperwork, going back and forth with your banker. It's something that it's nice to go through. You can evaluate 3 or 4 options by lunchtime, and then you can take a decision which one works best for me. And I think the third one, it's basically has to do with equity investors. Equity investors, you know, from angels to venture capital, even to family offices and other sort of alternative sources of capital that we have, they're all becoming very accustomed to when to recommend debt to companies and for what purpose. I can just give you guys one example. We have in our equity portfolios over 50 companies, all of them in the direct consumer space. And this is how Juice has been born, out of the requirement and the observing that 40 to 60% of the capital invested was going into advertising, various different forms of advertising, from digital to TV to other sources. And is this sort of wake-up call as an investor? Is this the best use of my capital? Or are there many ways in which I can de-risk an investment proposition by having a very well-priced product at the right time? So I think those are, in my view, the sort of three reasons why we're slightly more open. And I don't think it's too late. I think it just came at the right time. Our ecosystem was maturing for the past 2 or 3 years, and it just came in line with the explosion of investment, the explosion of companies in innovation that have capital.
As someone who has worked with banks for a large portion of their life, when you talked about friction, paperwork, and time to a decision, I almost had my head in my hands, but I had to keep up appearances for this podcast. So you actually touched on a couple of things there that I think are really important, because one of the questions I think that a lot of ventures ask is, you know, is this appropriate for me? Like, should I be looking at a debt solution or in a revenue-based finance solution? And I think for me, certainly, it falls into probably two camps. One is like, what is the right inflection point? When are your unit economics kind of going in the right direction? But equally, is your venture the sort of business that scales using marketing dollars? Would you say that that's fair? Is that who it's most appropriate for? Sort of D2C, e-com type businesses that have, you know, strong unit economics that can scale quickly with just that fuel? Or is there something else that you look for as well?
Oh, yeah, I think this is the point where I'm going to say it's something else. I feel that our market is becoming, at least sitting here in the UK, we're very privileged. We have the biggest concentration of venture funds, of providers of solutions for the innovation market. And it means that we can take the pick of everything that there is out there in the books and that has been created over the last few years. I fundamentally advise companies to take a different approach. Their products right now in the market, from very early stage, almost post-accelerator, all the way to the point where you're pre-IPO. And you have to understand what are the tools that you could use at each stage and for what. So if you're in the very beginning of the journey, maybe it's the advertising spend that really causes you a big issue, because you don't have the traction to go out there and raise your, you know, a large seed round, or to raise a very, you know, quite a lot of capital from, let's say, Clearco or Silicon Valley Bank. You may want to consider a provider that sits into this type of problem, that is able to lend you 10, 30, 50,000 pounds for you to be able to execute a specific function of your business. Very different company at a different stage could use a completely different product. Let's say a SaaS enterprise company with like 10 clients. They could use Pipe. You know, I think that that would be the best way, or invoice finance. I think that that would be a much more appropriate tool. And like me, I think you deal with this on a daily basis, where companies come with a particular problem. And I think it's our responsibility to guide them towards the right approach. I would say the vast majority of products, especially within revenue-based finance, more specifically, you have to have some form of repeatability. So whether you're a subscription, whether there's, you know, a point where you can have repeat purchases, So you have to do a bit of experimentation yourself with your own capital or with very early stage investors like family and friends and angel investors that naturally take a risk before you even have something to sell. Having a bit of predictability definitely helps because it opens up the spectrum of products that you could use. And then there's some, you know, I would say financial performance lingo that I'm going to use, like the lifetime value and the cost of acquisition. Usually this kind of relationship between lifetime value and cost of acquisition has to be a positive one. It has to be one where you have a multiple 2 to 3 to, you know, beyond is seen as really positive. If you're still very much early stage experimenting, the likelihood is going to be 1.5 to 2. So, and in some really bad months, like just before Christmas for vast majority of e-commerce companies, it's going to be even, you know, below 1 because you want to be out there, but the advertising cost is increasing substantially. So I think that there is no one type of company that this applies to. It applies to all of the companies that are in the high growth space, but depending on their business model, their sales model, how quickly do they take to recover the cost of acquisition of a client or a customer or a user, it might be a very different product that is relevant for them.
That's super helpful because I think it's very easy to then to just bucket sort of, okay, if you're D2C, go for revenue-based financing. If you're SaaS, go for pipe. If you're this, go for that, right? Because as you say, it depends on the mechanics of the business ultimately. And therefore, it also sounds like that founders should be thinking through quite a lot of sort of interplaying pieces before they make a decision as to whether they kind of move forward with something like revenue-based financing or some other sort of option as well. I'd be really interested in is actually also understanding how Juice is differentiating from others in the ecosystem because, you know, you described a huge swath of companies that are out there in this space in one way or the other, and they all have slightly different offerings, but a lot of them are fairly similar, I would say. So what is it that Juice brings to the table that you think that others aren't?
You know, amazing. I think what I'm really excited about Juice is that we're fundamentally entrepreneurs. Our partners have done quite a lot of investing. We're launching now a new equity fund for companies pre-Series A and Series A. And we've built the product with companies and founders in mind rather than the other way around looking at economics. Our approach is that marketing and marketing performance is at the core of our everything that we do. And we built a product that is very scalable from, I would say, post accelerator when you have just a little bit of traction to the point where you're beyond Series A, you want to be spending 8 to 10 million a year on advertising. We tend to focus on advertising. So we're almost like a single purpose, whether that is digital or whether that is TV advertising. We try to develop a product that is relevant for the world of marketing and of providing support over this important, I would say important transition from very early stage to seed, from seed to Series A, and from Series A to very recognizable brands that we are, we're seeing in the ecosystem. What is, I think, unique about our value proposition is that we've partnered with quite a number of organizations from technology to advisories to consultants in the marketing space to be able to offer companies almost like a rounded journey, an ability to tap into not just offers, exclusive offers created for them, but also with time and expertise. And I've taken the approach when I was building all of this that actually I want founders to not pay for things like this. So to absorb that in our cost of the product. And right now every client gets a digital marketing expert once a week. So they're able to pick up the phone or email or book time with someone that is able to guide them through those very tough inflection points. they're able to join our very specialized, unique sessions that we deliver for both our juice clients and, of course, our equity companies, because we want to be able to not just give them a lot of capital. And right now we are giving them substantially beyond the levels some of our competitors do or some of the other providers in the market. We're looking at somewhere around 3 to 5 times their revenues. So that is a substantial amount, even very early on. And we think that by coupling capital with our expertise, with what is really in our DNA as founders, as people that work operationally in businesses, we're going to find the right balance. I don't think that capital in itself can really push a company to grow exceptionally well. I think it's the human element and the community element and the network and the next level of investment coming in. So we see what we are building in Velocity and Juice as almost a finished solution from equity to the community to the debt product. And we want to work with amazing founders in the direct consumer space.
Awesome. So it's capital plus. It's that old kind of how can we be helpful, but you're actually being helpful, which is, I think, really, really wonderful. So I think, again, to your point, it's very easy for founders to potentially look at sources of capital, take that capital on, and then not have the right processes, have the right sort of experiments in place to really make best use of that capital, I think, as you said earlier as well. And I think having someone by your side that can help you tune the way that you use those funds so that they really are being used for growth, I think can be really, really powerful. So I look forward to seeing how you guys kind of grow and hopefully bringing a few ventures to you myself as and when they're growing. I wanted to flip out of talking about Juice and maybe focus a little bit about some of your background and history again. As an operator, you've had a background in law and finance. Like, what are the critical things that you believe ventures need to focus on really to achieve success? What are the most important things as an operator for you?
Oh my, that's a tough question. I know I've reflected on this before our conversation today. In my view, I used to believe that is about knowledge and network and all of that for many years. I'm getting now to the point where I actually have to work with companies hands-on and deliver growth. I think that the complexity that I've never really been aware of is how important it is to have a very solid strategy for digital marketing, for being able to implement over complex, you know, very complex optimization exercises across multiple social media platforms. For me, that is potentially where every new venture, especially if you're a direct to consumer, if you're in the subscription space, if you're really looking for a mass market, you're bound to deal with this complexity on a day-to-day basis. I feel that that is the skill that if I was starting my own business right now, that is what I would be looking for alongside technology and someone to help me build some viable product that I can take to the market. Without that, I think it's going to be very difficult for founders to stand out in this very crowded space that we have here in the UK, and even a more crowded place in the US. So I think whatever you're building, definitely focus your efforts into your commercial strategy, your digital marketing, because it's never going to be as simple as you imagine. Actually, it's probably going to be 100 times more complicated to really get the machinery working in the way that you want it to work and to acquire users at light speed.
I think that's super interesting because one of the tropes that kind of is around at the moment is that capital is ubiquitous, which I think it is, like for sure, but it's equally not, I wouldn't say that because it's ubiquitous, it's that easy to find. And in terms of when you do find it, you are competing against millions, certainly thousands of other startups that are all competing for that same digital kind of wall, right? Those eyeballs effectively. And if you don't have something from a commercial or a marketing perspective that is strategically different, or you at least have kind of an idea of how you're going to achieve scale, you're going to be basically pushing, you know, the rock uphill, because effectively, as I say, you're competing against other people that have as much funding, if not more funding, and all doing very, very similar things. So I think you're 100% right.
If I can just interject there for like a second, you said that, you know, it's not easy to find capital. I think in 2020, it was the first time ever that I've seen this barrier between founders and investors lowering to the point that if you're just go to LinkedIn, never mind using professional advisors and people that have been in the ecosystem to support you, you are able to get actually in front of vast majority of venture capital funds and for them to tell you whether this is going to be a workable solution or not. The difference now is that founders lack a way to benchmark themselves. So they don't necessarily know what great looks like. When I started in this space in my previous portfolio companies, going from 0 to 1 million in your first year was seen as exceptional. Today, going from 0 to 1 million is like average. And I think that this is where it gets really tricky for founders. Yes, you can get your 5 minutes with an investor, with any investor, including some of the best ones like Sequoia and Greycroft. They've announced now another $500 million fund for early stage, and they're looking at Europe even more so. So I don't think that that is the problem. I think that the problem is that founders simply don't have a benchmark. Is 0 to 5 million in your first year, you know, best in class? Probably not. Some of the best companies backed by VCs have gone 0 to 30 million, 0 to 100 million. And we've seen in the case of Kuzu, 0 to 175 million. So I think the question now for every founder should be, how far can I get in 12 to 18 months? Because the money then will follow if you're able to prove that it can deliver that type of growth.
I think really important for anyone listening to bookmark or whatever it is you do on a podcast, that kind of moment and that, you know, that insight from Flavia, because that whole shift, right, of speed to scale is pushing not only, I think, this whole conversation around when and where you can access funding, but who you can access that funding from and the amount of funding you could potentially access. And there's a lot happening in the market at the moment where we're seeing seed and series A rounds looking like late stage growth rounds with just huge amounts of capital coming in at very, very early stage. And that's obviously only going to happen if investors are seeing that level of traction or that potential level of traction in the businesses that they're funding. I think really important, those first 12 months of showing not necessarily run rate, but just that traction, that scalability is clearly even more important than it ever was before.
I could not agree with you more.
So moving on, and that's a great way to kind of seg into this other thought that I had or this other question I had. As an investor, what is the most important thing when you're evaluating a deal, right? Like, I mean, is it team? Is it traction, as we've just talked about? Is it tech? Is it market? I mean, because again, depending on the stage that you're investing at, whether it's, you know, at pre-revenue or whether it's at seed, whether it's series A, obviously these always change. But for you, what has to be there? Because I think for a lot of investors, traction comes later on in the game, right? And also, what is traction? Is traction revenue? Is traction users? Is traction something else? Sometimes it's team, sometimes it's market. So what is it for you? What is the most important thing that you're looking for?
Oh, that is a challenging one. Okay, so I would say when I was on the investment side, I've looked at quite a lot of companies from the very kind of industrial technologies all the way to fintech and consumer. So I've been in a very privileged position to have worked on a number of deals over the years. And I think it really depends on the type of company. If I was to just take one sliver of the ecosystem, let's say direct to consumer, so companies that naturally need to address a very large market, they're measured by the number of users, by the revenue they're able to get, the churn, their ability to have repeat customers or be able to put in premium if they're more in the subscription space, then naturally you would say that a really amazing team should be able to deliver quite a lot of traction very early on, because they would have been able to do a lot of this analytical work and testing work before launching a product. So that would be a way of measuring. And of course, when you're looking at the team, which early stage is always very important, because you're really backing the people rather than a very mature business that is very predictable and repeatable. No, absolutely not. You're not going to have that. There's still going to be a lot of fluctuation. You're going to have great months, bad months. You're going to try to understand why. But when you're looking at the team, you're looking at whether they've done this before in other companies. Though obviously, you're not required for the founder to have exited several other companies, but have they worked in another startup before that has been venture backed? Have they been able to go from 0 to 5 million, 10 million, 200 million? You look for those specific traits. And if you have a really great team that is gels well together, then you're going to see a strategy that is very, very pragmatic and is linked to the reality. They have done a lot of validation and tests early on. They've been able to create this sort of fellowship. Everything they do ties in together. They speak from the same hymn to some extent. So I think that is when you identify a really amazing team, and they have the highest probability of succeed in this space of ours. If I was able to identify that, plus the relevant skills, plus the right advisors, plus an amazing technology that differentiates sufficiently, then I think you're in a very early stage. You have all the ingredients that are required. And then it's all about the fun thesis. Does this fit in? Do you have already a company in this space? So just ensuring that from a fund perspective, you align that investment with what you're trying to do at a portfolio level. But besides those elements, I don't think that there's much that you can really validate early on. As you progress, of course, you have growth year on year, how much they've been able to progress. Staff turnover is another kind of indicator. If they haven't lost anyone and attracted some amazing people from other companies, then that is potentially quite a plus. And if they have a very bold vision of how they can take this company from where it is now to 100 million, 200 million of revenues in the next 3-5 years, and, you know, there's some understanding, some detail to the madness, then I think that, you know, you're probably in the presence of someone that is going to build a billion-dollar company. And you just want to jump on the wagon, right?
And I think that's one of the things that founders often forget is that if they are looking for venture funding, VCs are looking for that billion-dollar business. And why? Because ultimately that's how their fund returns work, right? So power law. I think that's really critical, right? The piece that you said there around the team. So it's about the sort of execution. It's about their ability to work together harmoniously, as it were. I mean, with, you know, harmoniously doesn't mean always in agreement, but certainly, you know, able to kind of make decisions quickly and move fast, right? I think often I see a lot of ventures that I've worked with where you either have indecision or you have sort of fragmented kind of chain of command, maybe, so that decisions maybe are made but then aren't executed particularly well because people don't really understand what those decisions mean for them. And then that all just drags on the business ultimately. But as you say, as an investor, you've got to be able to see how, at the very least, the founder or the founding team believes they're going to get to that 100, 200 plus a million of revenue. Otherwise, you haven't even got a starting point, right? Flavia, just as we kind of round things off, I think one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, you've been involved in the UK tech ecosystem for a number of years now, and it's evolved a huge amount over the time that you've been working within the ecosystem, right? So you'd have seen a lot of the changes whilst you were at London & Partners, at Funding London, and then at Silicon Valley Bank. What's been the most exciting thing, you know, an evolution for you in the UK tech scene?
And I think the most important one for me has been how investors have really departed from this mentality of just giving capital and then putting an inordinate amount of pressure on founding teams, to actually changing the approach completely and focusing on the value adds and bringing in a lot more than just the capital. And I know that conventionally, you know, even when I joined, there was the same kind of message out there by the funds that were present in, at that point in the market. But right now, actually, if I look at some of the best performing funds, I can see a very substantial offering and very consistent value adds with their portfolio companies. And not just the best, let's say the top of the portfolio, but actually doing something systematically across all of the cohorts. And I know funds like Notion that have probably what I would consider a best-in-class approach of bringing exited founders, experts from other regions like the US or Asia, working with their portfolio companies very hands-on. I think that this is perhaps for me the most exciting things, because it just tells you as a founder, if I am able to get to some of these investors, I'm going to be able to open the whole world to my company and be able to do things that I would have never been able to do anywhere else in record time. Of course, it creates another issue. It's a positive, of course, for some of the founders, but then it creates a complete mess for the vast majority of founders that actually are not invested by these amazing top tier funds. And I think that that is perhaps one of the most amazing things and one of the most frustrating things, because it's nothing worse than doing a job halfway through, as I've seen in some cases. I happen to advise on a number of companies, and now I've resumed my contract with the European Commission, and I can still see quite a number of VC-backed companies that don't have the right experience. They're very frustrated. And they often end up working with people like myself. And I know in your case, Arish, you work with a number of amazing companies in order to kind of complement some of the things that they really don't have. They haven't been able to tap into that through their own investors, which is very saddening.
That's really interesting. So it's, again, it's back to that capital plus kind of model that you talked about right at the beginning. Like, the money isn't enough nowadays. You've got to be able to back that up with experience, with network, with execution experience and ability, and that advisory to your portfolio co's. I think that's a really important message, because there are lots of advisors and founders and people who've worked within ventures for many, many years. And I think, you know, one of the things I always look for in a founder is someone who is able to surround themselves with the right advice without necessarily only listening to or taking on board that advice. So thank you so much for having joined me today. It's been a really incredible conversation. Where can our listeners find you? Are you on LinkedIn or Twitter? What's the best place to look for you and anything that they want to know?
You can find me everywhere, on LinkedIn, on Twitter. You can just add me, send me a message. I'm more than happy to join in and have a discussion. Please feel free to reach out. The lines are all open.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. Have a great day ahead.
Thank you, Arish. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?